Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only act within a narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at ideas around the country and talk to people who change what is politically possible. Joining us today is Daniel Crane, who is the Richard W. Pogue Professor of Law at the University of Michigan and a member of the Mackinac Center's Board of Scholars. Dan recently published a paper in the New York University Law Review that contemplates the future of antitrust law in light of technological innovations such as AI, quantum computing, and nanotechnology. It's a fascinating thought experiment and one that easily lends itself to questions about the Overton Window. So Dan, thank you for joining us.
Mike, thanks so much for having me on the Overton Window again. I'm delighted to be back.
Yeah, great. Thanks. This is your second time. So appreciate the time you've lent to us today. I'll start out, I must confess, I have not finished reading your whole article, but I did read the executive summary, and there's enough to unpack just in that that I'm looking forward to finishing the rest, because it's a fascinating thought experiment. You talk about and contemplate some really big changes using language like, you know, this might fundamentally reshape the economy. Can you describe as briefly as you can kind of the what you're contemplating here?
Sure. So just a little word of background about how I started thinking about these issues. I'm not particularly a technologist, but like lots of people for the last few years, I've been hearing a lot about AI and how disruptive it could be. So a couple of years ago, I decided I really need to figure this out. And so I started doing lots and lots of reading, both in sort of popular work and also in more specialized work and in technology and in economics and in marketing and in business studies. And as I was doing that, two things became clear to me. The first is that the technological revolution that we're going through is not just about AI. AI is obviously kind of the centerpiece of lots of it. But as you mentioned, there are other pieces as well that together are creating this, what Mustafa Suleiman, the founder of DeepMind and the author of this book, The Coming Wave, that I borrowed heavily from in this article, has called this coming wave of technological revolution. So it's quantum computing, as you said, it's AI, it's synthetic biology, it's robotics, it's nanotechnology, it's energy expansion, and other technologies that are kind of going to amplify each other in the way that waves will amplify each other and create a tidal wave, a tsunami, that is going to fundamentally reshape our economy and maybe at the limit reshape what it means to be human. And one thing I want to say is this is, as you said, this is a thought experiment. It's kind of peering into a crystal ball. I am not making any prediction that any of this will actually come true. What I'm doing is saying, you know, reading a lot of really smart people, people like, you know, Steve Schmidt and Henry Kissinger, who wrote a book together, you know, and sort of just spinning out the implications of these technological changes and saying, what if these predictions, they don't have to be 100% true. They don't have to be 50% true. What if they're even like 10 or 20% true? Mm-hmm. It is dramatic in terms of the implications for the way our economy is organized and for the area in which I'm an expert, which is antitrust law. So this article was just saying, let's look at these technological predictions and work out their implications for market economies and antitrust law that's intended to protect market economies.
Yeah, and one of the things that I was struck by was this idea of how these new systems and technologies can make use of information in ways that we rely on markets to distribute this information and to create it, really, in some ways. And so you're asking the question of what if we have a system in place where all of that information can be known and managed by a system, and then what happens, you know, to our the whole market, to the economy, to the regulations that apply to that? Is that kind of along the lines of what you're thinking?
That's exactly right. If you go back, I'm a big fan of Friedrich Hayek, and Hayek, obviously for libertarians, is sort of a demigod. And one
saint
of the
at least,
saint at least, right? But one of the observations that Hayek, I think, quite correctly made about the reason that centrally planned economies fail is that central planners never have enough information about what people really want and need to plan correctly. And so in the Soviet days, you'd get, you know, hey, this year we're going to get, you know, a million women's high-heeled shoes and actually no one needed them, right? So you just never actually knew how to supply human wants and needs because you just didn't have the information. And I think there's an entirely correct observation about why market economies are superior, among many reasons why market economies are superior to planned economies, which is that the central planner never has information and markets figure that out. But that is changing dramatically with these technologies, the ability to understand what people actually want in many ways before the people understand it themselves. And so In the article, I just go through a number of these technologies, many of which are already here. There's a fascinating example from the area of computer vision, a business case study about how in 2023, Disney caught up with Netflix and Amazon Prime, or digital streaming content, that it had fallen so far behind. And the way they did that was through a technology called... let me get this right. I don't know these technologies. It's factorized variational autoencoders, which are kind of neural network that manages to detect human reactions by scanning human faces for things like, are you frowning? Are you smiling? Are you looking bored? And so Disney set up in this 400-seat test theater these cameras and studied a million different facial variations. And from that was able to figure out what content people would like or not. And it was in ways that people probably couldn't even have expressed themselves if you surveyed them. Amazon has already patented a business method for anticipatory delivery, which means before you've even ordered something, before you even let me know what the product is, they know what you're going to want. And so, again, I'm not saying we're here yet, but one of the big trends of this technology is that the system of AI and other inputs is able to figure out and detect human preferences in ways that planners have never before been able to do. And just one more point about it is that it's not just that we're detecting pre-existing preferences, we're actually creating the preferences ourselves. So think about synthetic biologies and things like Neuralink, which is a way of having the computer directly interface with the human brain. And as Solomon asks, at what point, like, do we even know when it's the brain, when it's the computer? So the whole idea that human demand is kind of just out there to be discovered is going to be increasingly belied by technologies that in many ways are reprogramming or reconstituting human demand itself. Now, to be clear, like, I'm still a huge fan of markets. And this is not like my wish list for us to all become taken over by computers. I'm just looking realistically at the traditional justifications for market economies and competition and seeing how the coming technological wave is going to significantly erode those justifications.
Yeah. And that's a thing we need to be thinking about if we're going to try to avoid some of the downsides of this wave. I think that's another thing that comes clear through your writing, is that this is coming. It's not, no one is going to stop this. So we have to be prepared. One of the things that I appreciated about this outlook too was you trying to predict kind of how antitrust law might have to shift. So if the markets aren't there to be regulated anymore and the prices, and in one way this is a good thing, because if AI systems or this computing systems are operating in these spaces, then they're programmed in a way that will hopefully we will avoid fraud. It will be automatically avoided because it won't be humans running these things. It will be an automated system that we can control directly. But at the same time, then what happens to all these regulations? How will the antitrust laws need to change in order to provide some safety rails, guardrails over these new AI systems?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the paper, I just sort of start trying to think through what are the directions we could go. One of the interesting things about AI in particular is that it flips the way in which humans operate in the following way. So with humans, we can usually observe their actions. Like if a corporate manager takes this action or that action, we can, you know, oftentimes detect that. We can see what the things that they did. We know how to explain the processing steps that they took. The hard thing is knowing what their intentions or motivations were, right? This is something criminal law always struggles with. Like, how do we know what's really in someone's brain in terms of their motivations or intentions?
Right.
With AI-driven systems, as you said, Mike, a system where we kind of turn over discretion to a machine to make pricing decisions or output decisions or even product design decisions, it's just the opposite. Because with an AI, there's a big black box problem. You often just don't know why the AI did what it did. You don't actually see its processing steps. What you see, though, very clearly is what's called its objective function, the thing it's programmed to do. So every AI system is told to do something. And that's, you know, that's something you can directly infer. You just look at the way it's coded. It's garbage in, garbage out, right? And so this flips the experience we have with humans. With humans, motivations or intentions are opaque, but processing steps tend to be relatively easy to discern. With AIs, the processing steps are hard to observe, but the intentions or the objective functions are quite easy to determine. And that suggests a kind of a difference for antitrust policy, probably for other areas of law as well, where instead of trying to figure out, like, all right, so why did you do these things? What steps did you follow? Because that's a black box. The one thing we can know is, well, what were you trying to do? What was your intention? And what was, of course, computers don't have intentions literally, but what were your instructions? Right. And therefore, what was the thing you were trying to accomplish? And so that suggests to me that to the extent that we need to control these productive systems going forward, the whole apparatus needs to change from, you know, did you engage in predatory pricing or did you engage in some kind of exclusionary practice, to asking, well, what were you told to do? And maybe regulation we're going to have it needs to focus on the objective functions. Instead of the objective function being, okay, maximize the profits of the shareholders here, maybe it's, yeah, try to return profits to the shareholders, but also make sure that you're, you know, keeping prices low and output up, whatever it is, right? So again, I don't know if it's antitrust regulation anymore, but that's more of a model that focuses on saying, if we're turning over sort of autonomous decision-making to a machine, what's most important, or at least what's very important, is figuring out what that machine is instructed to do. That's its objective function.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, I know this is it's difficult to contemplate some of this just because it's forcing you to rethink all of these systems that we have in place, these institutions that we have built up around concepts of market economies and trade and regulations and those sorts of things. So I'm wondering too if, you know, from an Overton window perspective, these kinds of changes will need to be confronted by the public, and the public will need to be in favor of them or supportive of them in some way. What are your thoughts along those lines? I mean, do you think the public will readily accept these kinds of what appear to us to be total overhauls of how markets work and those sorts of things?
Yeah. I mean, my sense is that the public can't stop it. So there's, and one of the things that should be clear about is how quickly this is coming. I've read a lot of sort of the history of science and technology literature. And what often seems to happen is early in the days of a new technology, there's these overblown claims about what it's going to do. And you see this now with people like Elon Musk and other sort of thought leaders here. And we're going to have self-driving cars. Everyone has a self-driving car by 2025 or something. And of course we don't, right? So you get these kind of overly optimistic or pessimistic either way, but these over claims about how quickly this is going to change. And so after the early days of promise, though, it kind of settles into often several decades of like people saying, well, see, actually, this was all overclaimed. And the next thing you know, all of a sudden it becomes true, right? Which is the adoption curve takes a lot longer for all kinds of structural reasons. So where is the Overton window right now? And what's the public have to do about it? I don't think we're there yet. I mean, some of the things I'm talking about were clearly the technologies are there. Nanotechnology, though, is a great example. I mean, I think of all these technologies, the one that's potentially the most revolutionary is nanotechnology, which is engineering at the molecular level. And, you know, at the extreme, that's like the Star Trek replicator. You just tell it to produce the food you want, it produces it. We're nowhere near that yet, but we are getting closer to where nanotechnology is going to fundamentally start reshaping how manufacturing happens and the kinds of materials that can be used and the way environmental resources are consumed. And so we're on the cusp of lots of these technologies actually starting to have a bite in a real way in our economy. And so, some of my colleagues on the Michigan Law faculty are very skeptical of AI in the sense that they think we need to stop it in some way. And I think you can slow it down. You can regulate it in lots of ways. But look, if we stop it, the Chinese aren't going to stop it. You know, yeah. I mean, so I don't think this is something that we need to stop, as opposed to try to understand, anticipate, and stay on top of it as it evolves. And I'm actually, you know, I highly recommend reading Mustafa Solomon, The Coming Wave. It's a really smart book and terrifying at the extreme about the potential negative effects on our safety, our security, and other things of some of these technologies. But there's also an incredibly optimistic story that you can believe in, how this can solve many fundamental problems of economics, of the environment. And so I'm actually optimistic that if we stay on top of it and don't simply turn it over to any which way the wind blows, but sort of ask the kinds of questions I'm asking this paper, that we can get ahead of it and think in a smart way about how we want law and regulation to interact with it.
Yeah. And it seems to me too, that it's even if there is a 1% chance that this will, as you mentioned, as small of a chance this might have of coming true or to what extent it does, it's time well spent contemplating it and thinking about the downsides and the potential ramifications, because as you said, it is a wave and it will come to us whether we like it or not. And we need to be ready. You mentioned, part of what makes it unstoppable is the fact that there's international, this is, it happens at an international level, and there's international dynamics to all of this as well. So I wonder if have you given some thought to that? If the traditional institutions of markets become irrelevant, might the nation state be next? And how might that play out?
So one of the things in the book by Henry Kissinger, Steve Schmidt, and Daniel Huttenlocher about AI that I found striking, and they're, a computer scientist, the co-founder of Google, and obviously Henry Kissinger, now deceased, but formerly the world's smartest man, but obviously the architect of realpolitik during the Cold War. And, what they say is that if you play out the implications of AI alone for economic organization, you're going to continue to see the growth of multinational companies that are larger than almost any nation state. I mean, that's coming from the guy who co-founded Google, not hard to see that we're already there in many ways, right? Yeah. Enormous multinational companies. And like antitrust law can slow them. They can require divestitures. They can try to break them up. I think this really is an inevitable trend. And that's terrifying to lots of people, right? That's sort of the loss of control, maybe the loss of sovereignty. They're not domestically bounded. So again, you take an international global organization or effort to actually stop this from happening. And although I certainly think that stopping the worst excesses of it from happening are something that we should have international focus on, the idea that we're actually going to stop these technologies from developing, I just think is pie in the sky thinking. And so the real question again is as these companies develop in this way, how are we going to get effective control over them? Because we don't want, coming from the libertarian conservative perspective, I'm not someone who thinks that all businesses need to be controlled by the government all the time. But I think there is the potential for kind of really the loss of sovereignty. And I still believe in democracy and the rule of law and sovereignty, which makes me want to think about smart forms of regulation. One of the things I talked about in the article, and this is not me, I'm just reporting other people's ideas here in many ways, is how we're going to use AI to regulate AI, which is to say, if AI becomes smarter than any human regulator, which it's on the way to becoming quickly, then we really need to have democratically accountable AI tools that are helping us to regulate AI in ways that are going to produce the things that we want society to produce and not to produce the bad things as well. So again, those are the kinds of things I think people, citizens should be alert to, which is understanding the potential abuses of the coming wave technology, understanding the hopes and the ways these things could be good, and then particularly thinking about how are we going to regulate them in a smart way, not just antitrust, of course, because there's so many other dimensions to this. There's privacy, there's discrimination, there's all many other dimensions to these things, both for good or for bad. How are we going to have smart regulation going forward?
Yeah, it sounds like we'll have to face a challenge that has existed since we founded this country. And, you know, how do you at first get the regulators to regulate the public properly, and then how do you get them to regulate themselves? And I find, so we have kind of two challenges here. One is we don't want the mega companies to go out of control and have gain all of that control, and then we also don't want the government to use these tools, you know, and probably the story will be that they will be using these tools to save us from the mega companies. And, you know, we'll just become the mega companies themselves.
Exactly.
So, you know, how do we skate through that dangerous zone?
I totally agree. And you know, again, as someone who, like you, worries as much or more about the power of the government than the power of business, my vision is, again, this is not my personal aspiration to see, this sounds like socialism at the limit, right? Which is, well, you know, you have this big company that runs the whole economy, and like, Does it owned by shareholders or by the public? To me, like, that is a scary thought. And so to me, wanting to see regulation that continues to diffuse power in society, which is important, which continues to guarantee individual liberty and property and opportunity, the things that I really value as a libertarian, that's what I'm hoping to see here. So this project is not me saying, woohoo, this is coming and we can all be socialists. I mean, it's really not that at all, nor is it, woohoo, this is a new chance to regulate. We do regulate companies. It's called antitrust law. And my question is, how can we be smarter about the set of things we want antitrust law or its surrogates to accomplish to continue to achieve the kind of humane society with respect for the individual that is at the core of my political vision.
Yeah. And it seems to me that there's definitely some opportunity here to improve the way that regulation is done. I mean, I know you know all of the way that antitrust could be done better. So what are some of those ways do you think that this might improve the way government is able to regulate society and make it, and maybe we could get regulations that are efficient and effective and really beneficial?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is about requiring that when companies are turning over autonomous processes or semi-autonomous processes to AI-driven systems, that we have a good grip on what they're telling the system to do. And what safeguards they're putting in to make sure that when it's doing it, it's not transgressing other norms. I mean, a great example of this, not so much an antitrust question, though, is discrimination, right? So you tell an AI system, just go out there and maximize the profits of the firm. It may very well end up doing that, not because it's like consciously racist or sexist or whatever else, but if it doesn't take into account the consequences of what it's doing, it can end up with outcomes that really look rather regressive. And so I think it's not stopping the companies from using these technologies, but asking them to be accountable for what the objective function is. What are you telling the system to do, and what values are you telling it to be concerned about? In the same way we tell a human manager, right? You tell a human manager, yeah, we want you to go out there and make money for the shareholders of this company, but not in ways that break the law, not in ways that lead to disregarding the interests of people who are dependent on drugs or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. So it's making sure that our objective functions are humane and have in mind the values that we as a society are thinking are important. Again, a lot of risk in that because you're saying, well, let the government tell the computer what to do. I'm not suggesting that, but it's providing some kind of regulatory accountability for what these systems are being programmed to do.
Yeah. And what have you given thought to what the reaction might be from regulators themselves, from the federal employees who are running these federal programs and regulations? seems to me like they would be opposed to large scale changes or rethinking the way that they approach regulations. Might they block all of this, and how might that play out?
So do we actually still have federal employees? I thought. So I think you're right, though. I mean, I think there's, I've workshopped this paper and shared it with people, and one of the reactions I've gotten is sort of, no, like the real problem is that we can't let the AIs become monopolistic. And so what we need is not new antitrust thinking. We just kind of need old antitrust thinking applied. This is just another technology. It's like the same story we've always heard: industrialization and the internet and computerization was going to lead to monopoly. We've always said, no, we could break up Microsoft and AT&T and Standard Oil. It's the same story over and over again. I don't think this is the same story. I think this is fundamentally different. I mean, I think, again, we're at an inflection point for the human race, honestly, in terms of what these technologies could do. Again, even if that prediction is wrong, the idea that somehow regulation is going to stop it, I don't think is realistic. So this is contemplating a dramatic change in the job of antitrust law, the institutions, the way we think about things. I'm not suggesting we change that overnight. Again, as you started this podcast, this is a thought experiment. It's to say, be aware of what these technologies are, be aware of their predicted trend lines and the implications of those things, and then ask yourself, if these things start coming about, does it make any sense for you to continue doing the same job you've always been doing? And to me, clearly the answer is no. You have to rethink what the job is.
Yeah. Another thing that this is assuming, I think, is that the consumers will want all of this stuff. A lot. It seems like, you know, all of this in order for AI systems or companies to be able to do things like predict what people might want to buy next Tuesday, they'll need to get a lot more information from us about our behaviors and our body functions and our health and all these other sorts of things. And what if we don't sign up for that, or we don't plug ourselves into the matrix, you know, to use maybe an appropriate analogy?
Yeah, it's very matrixy, isn't it? At the end of the article, I sort of talk a little bit about this and say, I think even at the limit, even if all of this comes to pass, we're still always going to have some markets or some niche areas where you have the people who just want to opt out, or people who really value like the locally grown food by the local farmer and distributed in the kind of the conventional way. So none of this should preclude other kinds of market arrangements from continuing. And I think that they will continue. And I very much hope I can still go to the independent bookstore and kind of browse on the shelves and get the dust on my fingers, like things I enjoy to do. So again, I don't think this has to be all or nothing. I just think that, you know, one of the things we've seen with people and privacy is that people say they value their privacy and then they give it away for zero. Like, you know, so you look at, not stated preferences, but revealed preferences.
Yeah.
When people are given the ability to opt in to all the online goodies, they opt in. And so I think it's just, again, and it's inevitable that if you ask people, do you want the AI optimized version or not? Do you want the drug that's actually targeted to your biomarkers, or do you want the generic version? Lots of people are going to opt in to saying, no, I want to be genetically reprogrammed so I don't lose my hair. Like, you know, I'll sell that. And I think enough people are going to do that we're going to see these widespread enough consumer acceptance for big economic shifts to take place.
Well, your vision of the future here sounds to me like Brave New World a whole lot more than 1984. Is that fair? Is that preferred?
Yeah, it is. If you remember in Brave New World, like, who is the enemy? It's Henry Ford, right? So in fact, Ford becomes this epithet that people say, like, when they're cursing, because it's like the God's name. And in many ways, this is like the mechanization that Henry Ford, like Brave New World's about the assembly line, automated production, and the way that sort of can destroy the human soul. And it's obviously dystopian. I know there are people who think all of this is entirely dystopian. I'm not so convinced. I think that, again, I read Solomon, and I think there are clearly terrible dystopian paths where we're all, you know, someone gets CRISPR technology in their home lab and is able to reprogram, you know, some virus that destroys the human race. Again, I totally understand the fears, or AI, you know, reaches the singularity and then it's Terminator time. I get all those fears, you know, is the sci-fi aspect. But one of the things I want to say is, when you, again, having spent the time I did, not as a technologist, but sort of just trying to read and understand enough, it, when I read these predictions, and again, it's not just where the future, it's like technologies that are in place today being implemented in markets, I think there is a kind of a sci-fi aspect to this. And lots of sci-fi turns out, by the way, to be true. Like you read old sci-fi, it's like people, yeah, like, this is crazy stuff. And like, well, you know, it's televisions and radios and computers and, you know, beam me up. Right? That technology is actually not impossible. Nanotechnology, extraordinary potential for it. So again, maybe this is sci-fi, maybe this is dystopian, but at a minimum, I did my summer reading project. This is my book report. Like, here's what people are saying, and not just what they're saying, but what they're doing. And folks, let's just keep an eye on this because it has really dramatic implications.
Well, you have very different preferences from most people in what they want to read over the summer. But we appreciate you reading that material, and I'm looking forward to digging out all the nuggets of information and thought experiments that you have in the full article later. So appreciate the time today. Thanks for being on the Overton Window podcast.
Mike, thanks so much for having me again. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinaw.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.